and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, John McKinnon, author of The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. John, it's good to be back and to talk about how these cults emerge, and specifically as it relates to prophecy. I know that from the listener side, I know that there are a lot of people who are wondering some of the things that we're going to talk about, and they're pondering how all of this can be, because they have either got involved in a church or have grew up in a church where prophecy is a fundamental element of the church doctrine, and the prophecy isn't that accurate. That's really the sad truth about all of this, and I'm laughing just at the absurdity of this. It's not that it's really that funny. It's sad in a way, but it is absurd when you think about people, grown men and women, who have built their entire lives around something that they believe to be from God, and it's not true, and then they never make that next leap. If the thing that we're talking about and believing is not true, does that mean that the God who is giving these divine revelations, ideas to the leader, does that mean that the God is not true? And sadly, the reason this is so sad is because, sadly, it robs people of every credible ounce of faith that they have once they learn the mistakes. And I get people, in fact, I just got one last week, person who they're just really struggling because they came suddenly to terms with the fact that everything that they believed was not true, and yet they're surrounded by people who, some of them know it's not true, others are unaware, but they all just surround themselves with these beliefs in this prophecy or end time revelation, thinking that it makes them better than the church down the road. And I'm glad we're getting deeper into this, because I know, like I said, there are people contacting me. I know there are listeners who are commenting, and it's really good to give some examples and talk through why this is so problematic, but more to the point, why people choose to remain in such a problematic church.
Hello, John. It's good to be back here again, and we're on episode number 2 of what happens when prophecy fails and how to start a cult by having false prophecies. But we're getting into the background and covering that more thoroughly, because without this background, we can just present the reality of it and you won't understand the dynamics of what's really happening in the hearts of the believers and why they do what they do. So if you were to go out and talk to someone, you would have no clue as to why they can't see that a prophecy is clearly false and they can still hold on to their belief system. So all this background in these two episodes that we're doing right now is showing exactly why they do that. And there's many dynamics in the human nature that's going on, and we're all prone to do it, but recognizing it is one step in the direction of being able to live a life that's very true to yourself. And not trying to become, you know, just blending in with a group. You actually can live with a true identity and be who you are. So that's what we're going into for, and it's going to be 3 episodes here dealing with false prophecies. But the first two, this being the second one, we're covering exactly why people are continuing to hold on to their beliefs and hold on so strongly with these ties, even though you can clearly show that what they're believing didn't come to pass. This was true in the book we studied, Why Prophecies Fail, about the group that believed a flood was coming and the aliens were going to, you know, carry them off the earth and protect them from the flood that never occurred on the date they set, and why they continue to believe it afterwards. It's the same true for any group that sets a date, because we know date settings is not a very good bet. You know, for anyone, you would have to be of the caliber of Moses or Elijah or Jesus even to start setting dates, exact dates when things are going to happen. So I've never seen that in Scripture before, but we've got some pretty bold people nowadays that try to set dates. So we're going to get into this, John, and it's going to be a fun ride today.
You know, one of the questions that people ask me, and I have a really hard time answering, there really is no way I can answer it. I can give my opinion, which I'll I'll give partial opinion here. But one of the questions people ask me is, do these so-called prophets really believe what they're saying? And do they really think they're prophecy? Because in many cases, as I mentioned earlier, in many cases, the prophecies aren't quite true. Sometimes a detail here or there may come to pass, but by and large, the every detail of the prophecy isn't true. And if you believe in a God who is omnipotent and all-knowing, the God who's giving the man the prophecy is not going to miss details and get half of them right and half of them wrong. Or sadly, it's usually more wrong than right, especially the ones we've mentioned with Branham. Whenever these prophets give these prophecies, they will often talk about how accurate they are, even after it has been widely proven that they're not accurate. And the question really is, do these people believe what they're saying? In my opinion, I think some of them actually do. I think there are people who really believe that they're a prophet and some of the things that they're saying are true. And when it fails, they're a little surprised that it fails, and they move on and do it again and again. But there are people who really believe what they're saying is true. There are also people who do not. And if you go onto the internet and you start searching for people who are calling out some of the modern apostles and prophets, especially in regards to prophecy, you'll find that there's a whole array of people who are just saying things that aren't quite true. And some of them, I believe, in my opinion, they know that what they're doing is not prophecy, but it is a good way to earn money. I was listening to Chris Reed the other day, and some of the things that he said, I was watching a video with Mike Winger pointing out some of the things Chris Reed was saying, and it came right down to the way that he was trying to say that his prophecy came before the fact was that he was showing an iPhone, and he was showing the date at the top of the iPhone note. And see, I had this prophecy beforehand. And Mike Winger holds up his iPhone and says, 10 years ago, I said that Chris Reed would say this, and he made some adjustments in his phone and made the date change, and he could do the same thing. And so the question remains, do the prophets believe what they're saying? In my opinion, some of them don't. And I'll let you decide whether or not you think Mike Winger's example is one who doesn't. But in the end, there are people who are misleading the public for the sole purpose of having a ministry. And sadly, there are people who just have no other means to make money than to get other people to give them money. And that's really what we're dealing with here. Was William Branham in that category? I don't know. I've looked at some of his prophecies, and when you combine it with his statements on his mental health, it makes you wonder, did his mental health play a factor in the prophecies? And was his brain unstable enough to believe that these things failed? On the one hand, I think it's possible. But on the other hand, he often mentioned how not a single prophecy, not a single detail was wrong, and yet continued to change the details. And in one instance, in the India prophecy, he prophesied that he was going over, we'll probably talk about this later, but he was going to India, and you'll hear of tens of thousands times 10,000s being saved when I return. And we obviously didn't hear that. That has not happened in India, and it especially didn't happen when he returned. And so he had to admit that the prophecy failed. He admitted it. It's on recording. Everybody can go listen to it. And after admitting it, then he continued to say that my prophecies are all true and every detail is true. I tend to believe that was the point. It was eye-opening for me that I realized he doesn't really believe his own prophecies, and that's my opinion. I think there was a point which he probably did because of the mental health issues, but there came a time when he realized that I just had to admit that my prophecies have failed, but I'm going to continue to say that every single detail is correct.
That's so correct, John. I totally agree. You know, what we're really dealing here with this is human nature and how we're actually programmed to behave, because we're all human beings. All these things, you know, that cause people to stay in these groups is because of our basic human needs. It's a need to belong. It's a need to be around people, the need to have family, and the need to be loved. You know, people actually get their sense of being and belonging and purpose through membership in the group. And what we find out, though, is many times all of this is just a facade. You know, even within the groups, people need to be loved, but the God kind of love is not present, you know, within these groups. Only to the extent, they only show you love to the extent that you're showing loyalty to the group. And that's been demonstrated over and over, probably in your life, my life, and others. And the second question, the second you bring a question to the group about any things that would threaten the existence of the very group, and these are things like the false prophecies of, say, William Branham, or the lies that he told, or, you know, things that he said that were supernatural and really are not. You know, the second you do that, then the love that this group says they exhibit, and they say it's agape love, is shown to be what kind of love it really is. It's conditional. It's temporary. It's also manipulative and coercive, and it's really pharisaical and hypocritical altogether. It's been demonstrated that the love that these groups have is not agape love, because had they had agape love, they would endure long with you. They would be patient and kind. And as Paul says in Corinthians chapter 13, but the love I've seen in these groups is an instant turning you off, throwing you out, you know, calling you a devil. It's not the kind of love that God provides, because God's love is not a feeling. God's love is demonstrated through long suffering with the person. So for them not to hear us out, we just went through why they're not hearing us out and why they're not willing to listen, is because they can't stand the conflict in their minds. So the dynamic, it's a hot, this dynamic that you see there about this false love, it's a hallmark of the high demand religious environments where community and belonging are really powerful incentives to people to stay there. But then they're weaponized, is what we're talking about here in all these podcasts we've been doing, weaponized religion. They're weaponized to suppress independent thought. True unconditional love, you know, by contrast to this, persists, and even amid disagreements or questioning or withstanding somebody face to face, they still are your brother, and you're still willing to have a council with them. Think of Peter and Paul. Peter was siding with the Jews at one time, and they wanted to go back to the law. Paul confronted him to his face. They had a strict disagreement. The contention was sharp between them. But that didn't mean Paul threw Peter out on his head, you know, and said, you're no longer in our group. You're no longer a Christian. They worked it out. And the truth prevailed. Peter's so-called truth that he was holding on to turned out to be not what the gospel was all about. And it turned out the Judaizers that were trying to convert the Galatians and others back into Judaism was not the right way for the gospel. It was not a demonstration of the love from the gospel. Paul showed them that. They worked it out. And at one point, in I think it was Acts chapter 15 or so, they had to have a Jerusalem council to work out this thing between Jew and Gentile with the Christian faith. It didn't mean that they threw each other out and said, we're different groups now. No, they were one. But these groups that are high-control religious groups that have their own man of the hour, have their own prophecies that they've proclaimed, even though they're false, teach Scripture very contrary to what it even says, they will not fellowship with any other Christian. They have their own group. And it's sad to say, you know, they've just excluded them from the Christian world. And it's very sad for the people that are stuck in that.
It is sad. You know, I have lived in multiple states. I went to churches from Indiana, Arizona, South Carolina, everywhere in between. And in the cities that we attended church, there were, in some of the states that we lived, there were multiple Branhamite churches in the same city. And in most cases, not all, but in most, they did not fellowship with one another. They had their own special revelation. And if you understand the ancient world, how the mystery sects began and how they operated, how Gnosticism emerged, we have the divine mystery, nobody else does. Well, that was the way that Branham set up the framework for the entire movement. And then what happens is when these prophecies fail, people are left to try to give their own understanding as to why. Or if a doctrine is in conflict, if Branham taught doctrine, Trinity is a good example. He taught that anybody who believed in the persons of the Trinity had basically accepted the mark of the beast. He doesn't come out and say that, but he says basically that if you go down that pathway, you're lost because you have believed in the persons of the Trinity. And in another recording, he's praying to the persons of the Trinity. Multiple recordings he does, actually. And I'm told by some of the people who I've interviewed that in his early ministry, one of the problems he faced with the Pentecostals was he was baptizing Trinitarian in one church and then baptizing oneness in a different church, all while saying that he's one or the other, depending on which church he's in. So he doesn't really believe what he says. And what are you to do with this? People are left to try to reconcile because they are trained to believe this was a message from God, the last day end times message from God, and he is the messenger, so his message must be cohesive. But it's not. So what do you do with this? You try to come up with your own excuses as to why. When you do this, you end up with a doctrine that tries to solve the problems with his doctrine. And your solving of that doctrine doesn't match the church down the road. So they're preaching something else, and eventually the split happens, and they have to sever communication because they're preaching heresy. They're not uplifting our prophet in the way that we should be. Fast forward to the modern movement. That same problem continues to exist. You have all of these ministries who are saying things that some of it is just so heretical it was deemed heresy in the ancient world, and they're resurrecting heresies to preach as church doctrine while at the same time mixing all of the elements from Latter Rain that Branham brought, all of the failed prophecies that they have, and the reinventing of prophecies. They're basically making the mess bigger. And what happens is the people have to try to reconcile this. And so you've got these weird splits and divisions. But in the New Apostolic Reformation today, you've got all of these apostolic networks that are kind of feeding this. So you have the potential for a much bigger mess than we even see today. If it continues in the same pathway, I think the easiest way to say it is if you begin in error, you will end in error. And what we see here was beginning in error.
So I want to explore the area now of personal identity, because this gets to the core of it, because that's the heart of why people cannot let go and start new lives, you know, after they've seen errors. It goes even beyond cognitive dissonance, that initial discomfort that you're feeling. It goes down to the heart now. Not only do you have the mind trying to reconcile conflicting information, but now your very identity of who you are is being threatened. And that creates an even stronger response to stay within the group. So over time, when you get into these groups, you know, your belief shifts from what you're first presented and say, you might come out and say, I believe this. And over time, this belief system that where you say, I believe this, becomes, this is who I am. And we used to sing a song of the message, who I am, Lord. Who I am, I can see now who I am. I'm part of my Savior, I'm part of His Word. It's predestination, it's a revelation of who I am. That is what it becomes. And if the thing they were holding on to was truth, that would be one thing. But when you're holding on to a false religion, when you become that, then it's your very identity. So early on, when a prophecy is brought forth, it's usually an idea that people may have, I think this is true. But over time, in the group itself, with a false prophecy that is still held on to, you're saying, I'm one of the people who knows the truth. The belief is not external anymore. It's internalized at that point. And prophecies within the groups that we're talking about, and this goes for other things, the beliefs, it's a marker of their spiritual insight, because now they say we have the true revelation and the insight that only the elect's going to receive. And also, to get along to the person's ego, the pride, it's a badge of belonging. And it also gives them a dividing line between us and them. It always becomes, in the Christian world, we're the elite believers, and the rest of the Christian world is outside of that. So it's an us and them thing. Never should have been that. A wall is erected where we cannot cross over and fellowship with other Christians if you're in the message. You can have acquaintances, but you'll never fellowship, because their experience is totally different from yours, since you're outside the gospel, for one thing. And in the message, for instance, all we did was look upon other Christians with pity and wonder why they can't believe the message of the hour. Well, obviously, there's only an elect that would do that, so therefore you've put a wall. But Paul's gospel breaks down the wall. So these gospels that are false build walls. Paul's gospel broke down walls between Jew and Gentile, and they were totally different people groups. And even after Christianity came, there was things still different about them. The Jews didn't always live as Gentiles, and the Gentiles certainly didn't live as Jews. But yet they were Christians, and yet they had fellowship with one another. They weren't separated. God broke down the walls. So when you have groups building walls again, you can automatically say, well, they've departed from the gospel. So once that happens, you know, rejecting the prophecy would require you to reject your total identity around it, because you said, this is who I am. You know, the prophecy also becomes a source of meaning and purpose in your life. Well, 1977 has come and gone, but we're still looking for Los Angeles to fall into the sea. We're still looking for the manifestation of the sons of God, or the tent vision to be fulfilled, or some other thing to be fulfilled, or even some people say William Branham's coming back, being raised from the dead to fulfill these prophecies, to shoot the brown bear, to, you know, have the tent ministry, to speak the word, whatever it might be. So it's our meaning and purpose in life. We're holding on to these things, and we're not letting go of them. You know, the false prophecy, when they believe it is true, gives people a sense of being chosen. It gives them clarity in this confusing world we live in, because it can be very confusing. It also gives them extraordinary significance in this ordinary life. You know, members are no longer living day to day. They actually believe they're watchmen. They believe they're end time believers. They believe they are bearers of hidden truth that's been hid from thousands of years back. I can say one thing about the truth they do believe, which is not truth, but the things they do believe did come from many, many years back, from a lot of esoteric things and, what you might say, esoteric metaphysics, metaphysical things. So they do have, they are watchmen of prophecies or beliefs that were long ago resurrected, you know, in this time. But when prophecy fails, the person is not risking losing their prediction to just say, oh, it just failed. They risk losing all. Their whole purpose, their whole meaning, their whole spiritual importance. So when you risk all of that because your prophecy failed and you now have identified and said, this is who I am, there you go. The cost of losing all of that, easily you'll find a way to explain your way out of it. The cost of admitting error just seems existential. And I want to say that to mean it suggests that the consequences of acknowledging a mistake are so severe or fundamental that they feel threatening to your very existence or your identity or your core self. So that's the first thing. Another thing is, that's the second thing. The third thing is social identity. You know, it locks the belief in place when you're identifying with it and you have a social network. So the identity to these things and holding on to false prophecy is reinforced that way through friendships, through family ties, through marriage, even employment. Because we know that in some message churches, they provide employment for the people. And your very spiritual life, they're intertwined with this belief. So leaving the prophecy, if it were false, will mean you lose all that community. You lose all your social relationships. You could lose your family. It also means that you've got to come out publicly and say, I was wrong. And that's hard to do. Becoming one of the ones that fell away, and you need to come back to the truth. So people aren't just choosing here between truth and error. They're choosing, if they have to leave the prophecy, they're choosing to whether they belong to a group or whether they're going to find themselves in isolation. And it's a scary prospect. And that's why psychological support groups are very necessary for people coming out of these groups. That's why we need a strong support network to encourage believers that come out of these groups. Because a lot of times we're many miles away. We don't have direct contact. But there is support out there, and people need to look for it. So fourth, you know, their sacrifices turns the belief into self-justification. You know, the more you sacrifice for the group, for this prophecy they're holding up, the more central it becomes to your identity. So that sacrifice could be money. You know, I know many of us in the message believed it so strongly, we just were willing to know that the Lord was coming so soon that we're going to give away a lot of our money because we want to see the message proclaimed. We want to see people come into the group, and we know there's a reward for doing so. We don't do it for the reward, but we do it because we believe in it so strongly. Now, it's sad to find out that all the things that you invested in that later may not be the reward you were thinking of. And, you know, at the time we believed it, but now that we find out, we're sometimes very disappointed. But these sacrifices cause you to bind yourself to the belief system. You're not willing to lose your investment. The time, there's a sacrifice of time. We've gave huge amounts of our time to thinking about this message, trying to figure it out, trying to understand all the contradictions on the tapes, trying to understand what is he really saying? What am I to believe? We listen to tapes over and over. I was involved in this a long, long time ago, back when we had floppy disks that were 5 1/4. I transcribed one of the sermons. Somebody asked me, I was asked to transcribe the resurrection of Lazarus that William Branham preached. And I spent many hours doing that and then submitted the document so that it could be uploaded to the, you know, the message search platform. Many of us printed messages. Many of us copied tapes over and over and sent them to the foreign fields. I know our church did that quite a bit. Also within the message, you tend to choose the career that's going to put you in close proximity to a church. And unfortunately, at the time, there's not many. They're very scattered. So you had to choose areas that would put you in close enough proximity to a church. So it limited maybe your career opportunities. You turned down opportunities or career paths because you couldn't be near a church. So you've got that investment. Now, you've also got your reputation to consider. You know, we had to first come out and say we were a fanatic. And when I first came out and believed the message, I was seen as somebody on the outside, a fanatic, you know, somebody that was just out of his mind. But now, if we find that the prophecy is false, we got to now back that up. You know, we got to backtrack and say all that we did to become a fanatic in one sense, we're now having to become a fanatic for another reason. We're now having to admit that we were wrong. So our reputation's at stake here. A lot of us are not willing to give up. So for those things that we've got invested, that we've sacrificed our very lives and the bulk of our lives, bulk of our productive lives, admitting the prophecy was false and admitting the message is wrong or admitting the group that I'm in is wrong would mean that you have to admit that I gave up years of my life for nothing. To avoid that conclusion, the mind will work hard to reinterpret that failure, that prophecy, or whatever you're looking at as false doctrine or whatever it might be, to look at it as right or to reinterpret the failure rather than abandon your belief.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started? or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. I've mentioned this a few times, and I don't think it can be mentioned enough. As I was trying to deprogram from all of this stuff that was in my head and trying to understand the Bible, because what we were taught the Bible said in many cases was not what the Bible said. So I began reading the Bible over and over, trying to read it for myself and not for what I was told that it said. And it reads differently if you do that. We were reading it through the lens of somebody else's opinion, and often those opinions just really didn't match. And so I began doing this, and one of the things that was most surprising to me, I've mentioned this before, reading the New Testament, one of the sins that is mentioned the most is pride. I was a little bit surprised at this because in the message movements and all of the movements that stemmed from it, there is an indoctrinated sense of pride to be part of the movement. You are prideful that you are in the movement, and you are prideful that you're not like the church down the road. It is exactly like you said, it's an us versus them mentality. We're the elite, they're the ones that are not, and I'm prideful because of this. And yet pride is a sin, so how do you reconcile this? And that I struggled with that quite a bit because I did not know how to overcome this. I was prideful, I was arrogant, I was not a good person, and I came to terms with the fact that the movement had made me not a good person. From birth I was raised to be like this. And why is that? Why would you want to be like this? And then I started thinking about how difficult it is for people to leave the movement. And I was surprised even more whenever I learned the first prophecy that I had encountered that had failed. And there were many, but the first one that I found, I put it on the, I had a, like a little note system that eventually became my website. I put it on up on the website, and I thought everybody would just leave because why would we believe in a false prophet? That's how my mind was wired. If it's not true, it's not true. We walk away. But people stayed, and I could not figure out why is this. And I came to terms with the fact that it is because of the indoctrinated pride. It takes a lot of humility to admit you were wrong and to admit that you believed in something that was wrong. And the only way that you can make something wrong sound true is to engage in circular reasoning. Yes, it's wrong, but yes, he also had every single detail correct. But at the same time, he was wrong. You go in the circle countless times, and anybody who has encountered not just the message cult, but any of the others who are built on prophecies that didn't really happen, that's the first thing they say. Why do they do that? You'll enter into a conversation, and it begins the circular reasoning process. Why is this? And I have, like I said, I've come to terms with the fact that it is just simply pride, and it takes a lot for a person to humble their pride.
When prophecy fails, you know, reinterpreting that is very easy. And it is a psychological self-defense mechanism that we do naturally. We naturally, when first confronted, that's why you never want to confront somebody and just blast them with the truth, because they will just put up defense mechanisms automatically. They'll bring the wall up and then it's over. Your common responses to these things when you've put up that wall is that, well, it was fulfilled spiritually, or it didn't come to pass in 1977 or 1914 or 1844 because God was delaying judgment. He was extending his mercy. Or we just misunderstood the timing. Or our faith actually changed the outcome of this because we're the bride. We're still here and we're holding back judgments. So These explanations help to preserve our identity. It helps us say that, well, I wasn't wrong. We none of us want to be wrong. It helps us to say we weren't deceived. We still know the truth. Or that we're still special. And this truth that they hold on to becomes the truth that's actually there, the reality of it. It's always secondary to their self-preservation and the preservation of all these things.
There's another aspect to this as well. I think you and I have mentioned it in Weaponized Religion, but cognitive dissonance does play a factor. There are people who suddenly encounter something that is wrong, whether it's a failed prophecy or a doctrine that's incorrect, and the divine messenger's message has critical flaws. They'll encounter it, but they try to reconcile it, because in this belief system, if you're believing that the person speaking is anointed by God and that the words coming out of their mouth are from God, then what happens is whenever something is said that is incorrect, you try to reconcile it. Yes, that's incorrect, but look at this other thing. And there's a deflection that happens, and then the deflection becomes the answer to the problem, and it turns into a type of circular reasoning. But what it is, the brain is trying to reconcile two polar opposite things and make them fit together. An example of this, I was talking to a guy, and for those who don't know, William Branham, part of his stage persona was that he was born on a specific date, and a mystic woman had accounted for his date in her study of the stars and the moons and the planets and said, did you know you're born under a sign? And that ministry was tied to his Moses ministry. He would say, as Moses was given two signs, so am I given two signs. That year that he gave us his birth year was 1909, so the stars and the planets, 1909. But yet, in his Elijah ministry, it was a bit different. He said Dowie was born on one day, John Alexander Dowie. Dowie died on one day, I was born the next. Well, that year is 1907. So his Elijah ministry, as an Elisha to John Alexander Dowie's Elijah, would be 1907. Both dates can't be true. And if you take away one, you take away his Elijah ministry. If you take away the other one, you take away his Moses ministry. And then at the same time, the government records don't match either of those dates. So I was talking to this person and I said, well, he can't be born in both years. It's impossible for a person to be born in two separate years. And the guy actually responds to me, I don't understand it, John, but I believe every word the prophet said. And there's nothing you can say to this. People ask me, how do you interact with somebody who's doing this? Well, there is simply no way. Once logic is disconnected from the brain and cognitive dissonance is causing the speech to be incoherent, there is not a way that you're going to convince a person that, no, that's not possible, my friend. You cannot be born in two different years. But sadly, that does play a factor, and it's really hard to watch. I feel really a lot of pain for people who are trapped in this kind of ministry, because they themselves can't really easily get out. It takes a lot of work to reconcile the pride that's in their head and all of the mental psychological effects that this type of movement has on them.
Again, I totally agree, and I just say this is a very interesting material here we're covering today. It's a great background, and it really hits at the core. You know, I'm glad this research was done, because all these things are not my original ideas, but I can sure relate to everything that's being said, everything I've read in this book, everything that held me to the group I was in all those years. I can readily identify with that. I think everybody else can too, that's come out of it. But now we're going to go into a couple of other things, points 6 and 7, about why it's so powerful. You know, once the belief becomes your identity, you know, the reason you can hold on to it and why it's so powerful, you can so powerfully hold on to it, is because when you bring evidence before people that are in these groups, then it automatically feels like an attack on them. You know, your questions within the group, if you're within the group and questioning to the people in the group that believe it, it feels like you're betraying them. You feel like a Judas. And they think of you as a Judas, either by you questioning, or even if they were to question, they would themselves feel like they were betraying the group. And then the doubt, it makes them feel like they're a moral failure. especially, as we said, when they got so much invested in it. So the person is no longer protecting the idea at that point. They've abandoned the fact, and the facts may speak for themselves, and they say, this prophecy was not true. I understand that. William Branham lied. I understand that. Now it shifts. They're not protecting that anymore. They can discard that. But they're protecting themselves. That's why clear disproof of any prophecy often fails to convince anyone in the group. Logic alone, you know, critical thinking alone, does not persuade them. And confrontation to them, it only hardens their belief in it. And eventually it'll turn you off altogether and they won't speak to you. So number seven, here's the tragic irony of all this. You know, false prophecy is claiming to offer certainty, security, and truth, you know, to the believer. When it was originally proclaimed as prophecy, it gave the believer something to hold on to, that because they believed the person to be a prophet, it gave them certainty, security, and truth. But then when it becomes identity, and your very identity, then it becomes, it traps you in fear. And the fear of being wrong when it's determined to be false. The fear of loss because of all your investment. And the fear of the collapse of your very being. The very thing that promised the meaning in their lives now demands their loyalty at all cost, and at the cost of being honest with themselves. So now they become dishonest with themselves. Now they're forced to defend the group out of fear. Now they are forced to deny who they really are and be absorbed into the group. And they now live a lie after that. Prior to that, I could say we could excuse all the times we believed it because we knew no better. When somebody lies to you and you repeat it, you don't know that you're lying, because you're sincerely believing it and you have no evidence to the contrary. But once that contrary evidence comes to play, all these factors we've mentioned today, you know, play a key role in keeping you there. So it's a very important statement to say that people are now living a lie, because there's so much dishonesty, I would say, in the message. Now it's just mind-blowing. Ministers intentionally are dishonest nowadays, really to protect themselves at all cost. You know, they give themselves the freedom now to tell lies, because William Branham told lies, and because they say Abraham told a lie. And they know for a fact and will admit that William Branham lied about things. It's very dangerous, I would say, to be in the message nowadays for that very freedom, because Paul warns us to lie not one to another. You know, don't lie one to another, but message ministers will excuse themselves if they tell lies, because they believe it's an acceptable practice in Scripture. And I think they're very wrong about that. But so in their position as pastor, they're actually given many things of power. They're given the keys to the treasury, and a lot of them manage it to their own benefit. Churches, and the ones that I know about, they're not run totally transparently where finances are concerned. And this is another danger. You know, the church that, say, I was a part of for over 10 years never published not one thing about how much money was collected, about how much the pastor made, about how much was given to missions, or anything else. We gave our money religiously, dedicated, but we never heard anything about it. Now, we did hold a camp meeting once a year, and the amount given in those offerings was mentioned. But in our day-to-day giving in the church, nothing was ever transparent. And that's unfortunate. The men controlling the money may have been trustworthy. You know, this church may have been trustworthy. But nowadays, it's unheard of to have finances so hidden from public view, because nowadays we know, with all the corruption that has been shown over the years, every church should be transparent. The church I go to now publishes a statement at least twice a year about where every single dollar and penny goes, down to the pastor's salary to the pastor's retirement, how much they're given to that, how much they're given to missions, how much they're given to various ministries. So these churches should be transparent. There's no reason not to be, unless you're trying to hide something. But for many churches in the message and others, it invites men to become corrupt and hoard the money and to use the money wrongly. And we saw this case recently of the pastor down, you wouldn't probably know where it is. I can't think of where it is. He hoarded $28 million and was only forced to bring that out when the country was going to change the currency. Now, why was a pastor hoarding $28 million in funds given over the years? What was he going to do with that? Why wasn't he using it to further the message? Why wasn't he using it to give to missionaries who needed bread and water on the field, or shoes, or transportation, or Bibles, or you name it? Why was $28 million hoarded? I can think of the camp meetings we came out of. We might collect anywhere from $80,000 to $250,000 at the most after every camp meeting once a year. But this man had $28 million in boxes in cash that he wasn't doing anything with. Now, how can you say a message pastor really believes what he is proclaiming? You know, if any pastor would think, I would only what I need to live on would I take, and I needed to give the rest to benefit somebody, to benefit the gospel. But he obviously doesn't believe the gospel he's preaching, holding on to $28 million.
I grew up hearing sermon after sermon after sermon from a preacher talking about the fivefold ministry, how God sent prophets, apostles, evangelists, teachers, and preachers, and these offices are ordained by God, and you touch not God's anointed. You can't question these people because God is speaking through them. And then there weren't the five. William Branham was really all of them. If you count the preacher who's saying it, you really have a twofold ministry. But the preacher who's saying it is often just quoting Branham. So in effect, you've got a onefold ministry, preached as a fivefold. But look how it developed into what we see today. You have these apostles who aren't apostling. The word apostle means to go out. You're going out, you're sent as basically as an evangelist, but an evangelist with the authority of having seen Jesus. None of them are doing this. They're not really upholding their office. And yet all of this money is coming in. The money's coming in to further the gospel, quote unquote, further the gospel. But what do you see? You see bigger buildings, you see bigger containment units for the people going to the church, not the actual spreading of the gospel. So if the mission is to have a fivefold ministry where the gospel is being spread until Jesus returns, how is that spreading the gospel? How in any way, shape, or form is this doing it? I know that there are some, even in the Branham religion, there are missionaries. I'm not saying that there aren't, but in many cases, I would say in most cases, it's usually the minister who's speaking who is bettering himself by the money that's coming in. I don't see a whole lot of it going anywhere. This is a problem for me, and it was a problem that I had just even regionally. Think of a church in a city. If you believe that every other church was wrong, which is what they teach, every other church is wrong, I have the truth, and it is my truth in my church that makes our church go to heaven and join into this rapture theology. We're going to go to the rapture while every other church stays here to suffer. If you really had this, you would be knocking down the doors of the other churches trying to save those people. You don't see this. You don't see the money being applied to do this. For me, it's a huge problem.
So the bottom line here, we're coming down to the end. Commitment to the false prophecy endures because abandoning it would be these things, rewriting your own life's history, your own life story. You're essentially like those who I would think are in the government's witness protection program. You actually have to get a brand new identity. You actually have to start over if you abandon the prophecy. Also, you are surrendering your cherished identity. For many, the fellowship and the relationships and the movement were not all bad. you know, we had some good, wholesome fellowship, healthy, and it met our needs as a human being. But you would have to surrender all that. And you face a painful loss in your life. It's true for anything we have to let go of in our lives that had a high impact once. We all suffer by leaving that. And so for many, that feels harder than just taking the prophecy and reinterpreting it. That's so much easier. And that's why many, many have not left, and why many have not let their minds even question or let alternative thoughts in. So, John, I think we've laid the foundation here and for what is to come in the next episode. You know, when we present our obvious the obvious failures of prophecies, you know, people will no longer have to wonder why the followers, you know, don't immediately leave in droves and droves and find new churches to go to. Because it's because of what we presented today. Unless they experience that triggering event, their minds will just stay locked in and controlled, and they'll just want to avoid the pain like we all do. So what I believe they fail to realize, though, even if you show them the gospel that they preach is a false gospel or a pseudo-gospel, which is no gospel at all, you know, the ministers and lay people have just not come to the place yet where they can see that following the true gospel is far better. Most believe they follow Christ in the message we came out of, because they'll say Christ is the message. But as we've shown in other podcasts, you know, the Christ of the Bible, the Word, you know, is not the same as they're promoting. You know, what it shows is that they would rather hold on to what has made them comfortable in life, what they've invested their life into, what they've given their lives over to, is better than taking the costlier, harder way of the true gospel. So I look at it this way, and I think of men like John Bunyan. If you go back just a few hundred years, he stood for Christ rather than take the easy way out. You know, and then what he endured because of that. You know, leaving the message is far easier in this day than what John Bunyan experienced in his day. You know, Bunyan was imprisoned for unlicensed preaching. All it was preaching. And it was under what was called the Conventicle Act. It was related to Restoration-era laws enforcing conformity to the Church of England. And remember, the Church of England was started after Henry VIII broke away from the Catholic Church to start his own church. But he refused to stop preaching back in that day without the state approval. So listen to what he had to endure because of that. He had to endure 12 years and 6 months of prison. His first imprisonment was for 12 years altogether. And the second time he was in prison because he wouldn't stop preaching was for about 6 months. But look at the personal cost to John Bunyan. He could have taken the easier way. He could have let all the things that he had invested in his life to supersede the truth. His wife and children had to suffer severe hardships because he wasn't there as the breadwinner. His daughter, one of his daughters, Mary, she was blind. So think of the care that she needed. That weighed heavily on him, and is frequently he mentions it in his reflections. But still, he chose to remain in prison. He could have gained release at any time if he just promised to stop preaching. Stop preaching the gospel, John Bunyan, and you can go back to your family and you can make a living and have a good life. But he refused. He viewed the imprisonment as obedience to Christ rather than rebellion against the state. So in this day, when we present believers, say in the message, with contrary facts to what they're believing, and they choose to hold on to the message rather than just leaving and starting a new beginning, then they're not seeing obedience to Christ better than remaining in a pseudo-Christian religion. It really is a shame. And they're not going to have to experience prison for leaving. They would have hardships, because we're going to have that. But serving Christ is not always easy. And Jesus never did promise us a rose garden all our lives or the comforts of being around friends and family. Sometimes we do have to take the harder road. So I would leave it with that. You know, choose this day whom you will serve.
Well, that's very good advice. And that's where my family was in 2012. We had to make a choice. And I think every single person, whether you're in the Branham Group or one of the others that we're talking about, every single person has to come to that place where they have to make a decision. Am I going to choose the easy path and stay in this error, or am I going to take the much harder path and come out of the error? And sadly, there are people who make the conscious decision, I'm going to stay in the error because it is much easier. So it's a sad truth, and I feel real pain for people who are stuck in it, because I know exactly how hard it is to come out, and I know what you face whenever you face that decision. I faced it myself. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more information about Roy Davis and William Branham, you can read The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.